From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch, filling in today for Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made April 14th when a local elementary school principal was arraigned in Greasetown Court. And as you may suspect, this hour we will be discussing content that may not be appropriate for young children. So if you are listening and there are kids nearby, please do whatever you think is best for them and for you, if it is something that may be triggering for you as well. Less than 2 weeks ago, Northwood Elementary School principal Kirk Ashton was charged with sexually abusing students at his school in the Hilton District. State police say there are now 11 victims, all of them boys, all between the age of 8 and 12. Monroe County District Attorney Sandra Dorley says the current allegations date back to 2017, and she says all of the incidents happened at the school during school hours. Now, the DA's office says the exact nature of the allegations cannot be discussed because the case is under investigation, but Ashton already faces a number of charges, including first-degree sexual abuse, second-degree course of sexual conduct against a child, and endangering the welfare of a child. During a news conference the day after the arraignment, Greece Police Chief Drew Forsyth called Ashton, quote, a predator. He became emotional when he said, quote, this guy is charged with protecting, guiding, and mentoring these children. We drop our kids off every day to this guy, and he does this, allegedly. It's the worst thing that can possibly happen in my mind, end quote. He accused Ashton of using the boys' innocence and trust to violate them. Hilton Central School District Superintendent Casey Kasorik says the district has been working closely with Bavona Child Advocacy Center throughout the investigation. Over the last 2 weeks, Bavona's executive director, Deb Rosen, has offered advice and direction for parents about how to talk to their children about alleged abuse. And she joins us this hour, along with fellow experts, to talk not just about this case, which, of course, has been affecting our community in deep ways in the last few weeks since it became public, but also about the broader issue of child sexual abuse. How prevalent is it? And experts say most perpetrators are known and trusted by their victims, so how can it be prevented? We invite your questions and concerns this hour as we have this sensitive conversation with our guests. We are joined this hour by Deb Rosen, the Executive Director of Bavona Child Advocacy Center. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
Stephanie Schwebke is the Manager of Community Education, also at Bavona Child Advocacy Center here in Rochester. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Dr. Elizabeth Murray is an assistant professor of pediatrics and a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital, part of the U of R Medical Center. Dr. Murray, welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
And Dr. Renee Sorrentino is joining us from Boston, where she is the medical director of the Institute for Sexual Wellness and a clinical assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Sorrentino, welcome.
Thank you.
And as we will explore, you have a connection also to this case that we will discuss in a little bit. I don't want to spend the entire hour talking specifically about Hilton, and I know there are a lot of limitations, especially given Bavona's role in what you can and can't say about what we know about what happened. But I do want to spend some time on it now to begin, because obviously this has been a big deal in the community, and these allegations have raised some broader questions about the impact of child sexual abuse. So, Deb Rosen, let me start with you as we invite our listeners to join us as well. 844-295-TALK is the phone number. Locally here in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email us at connections@wxxi.org, and you can tweet at me, at Scott Feibusch, all one word, if you'd like to respond that way. I can respond to you that way as well. So, Deb Rosen, Executive Director of Bavona, let me start with you. What is, as this case has percolated through the community, as Bavona's role in helping to bring the case to light has come forward, as you look at this now a couple of weeks out, where are you on this right now? What are some of your reactions to how the community has reacted?
Sure. Well, I think my first and perhaps strongest reaction is just a tremendous sense of compassion for the community of Hilton. And I think what all of us who are sort of witnessing this event unfold are seeing is an entire community that is really rocked, that is very much in shock, very much in disbelief. And in particular, we're seeing parents that are struggling to manage their own feelings and responses to what has come to light and what is alleged, but also who are struggling to be who their children need them to be. So we're really seeing parents who want to know the best way to engage their children about this topic and the best way to support their children around this topic. And I'm really very glad that Bavona is able to be of assistance to that community. And I just have a very strong sense, of compassion. I also have a strong sense of gratitude for the role of prevention education in communities such as Hilton. Bavona has the opportunity to partner with several school districts to provide comprehensive interpersonal safety education that protects.
Deb Rosen, are you still there? We seem to have...
Resources exist.
There we go. All right, Deb, your connection dropped on us for just a second there. Deb and also Stephanie Schwepka, let's kind of recap a little bit, too. I mean, it's becoming clear, to me at least, from some of the reporting that we've seen on this, that a lot of the reason that this came to light was because Bavona was involved with some of this preventive education at Hilton. Explain to me, to the extent, obviously, that you're able, because of privacy concerns here and everything, what was the role that Bavona played in actually bringing this situation with Kirk Ashton to light there?
Well, we can't
say the role was what... Oh, go ahead, Deb. It's okay.
We can't comment on exactly what the relationship between our educational curriculum and the disclosures were. That's not for us to comment on. But what we can share is that we have been providing direct instruction prevention education in the Hilton Elementary Schools this spring and late winter. And that is providing students with a lot of information about sort of the warning signals of grooming behavior and unsafe physical contact and how to identify safe adults and get help when they need it. And so elementary schools in Hilton were receiving that education.
Stephanie, did you want to add to that?
No, I think Deb did a great job.
Stephanie Schwepka, you're the manager of community education at Bavona. What are some of the reactions that you're hearing? I'll ask you the same question that I asked Deb Rosen. What, you know, as this kind of sinks into the community, what sort of questions are you getting now? What are parents and caregivers and what are schools asking you now in light of this?
I think from a community standpoint, they just I think Deb described it perfectly. You know, they've just been kind of, you know, sort of rocked by it, and taking an approach of, you know, prevention education longstanding has been about preventing something from happening in the first place or preventing from happening again. And the community is just so strong in their willingness and eagerness to prevent it from happening again. And that's what, those are the conversations we're engaged in. And those are the things that Bavona would like to provide from a, you know, from a training standpoint and the prevention education piece of that. I'm getting a lot of, you know, phone calls and questions from other school districts with the realization that this could, you know, this can happen in any community. And that's really such a strong message we try to send in the prevention education world, is that this really can happen. It's one of the messages we always say is, you know, child sexual abuse can happen anywhere with anyone. It crosses all, you know, socioeconomic, gender, racial boundaries. It can happen anywhere. And I think a lot of school districts are realizing, you know, this can happen anywhere. And they want to know, you know, they want assistance in making sure that it doesn't happen again. So that's a little bit of a lot of the questions that I'm fielding right now.
In terms of where you're actually active now in providing these education programs, I'm sure Hilton was not the only district that you were working with before. Is there now more of a call for this from districts that realize the necessity and the importance of it?
Absolutely. We're involved with about 8 school districts right now. And the hope is to grow. I would love to make this a Monroe County calling, you know, in the Hilton community and all of our, you know, all of our communities around the county. So
is this something that's provided? Do districts pay you a fee to provide this to them? What's the funding for this look like?
Sure. So we are part of a bonus partnered with BOCES too. We have a wonderful partnership with them. And to utilize language that's really familiar to school districts, we are involved in some COSER agreements, some collective service agreements, cooperative service agreements, so that we can provide this service to the school districts in a way that is financially, agreeable for school districts. So that's been the way right now that we've been engaging with school districts. But school districts could decide to purchase the curriculum on their own if they wanted to. But it's absolutely a wonderful idea to partner with BOCES and to partner with Bavona to achieve those desired results that this curriculum in particular that we've adopted through the Monique Barr Foundation provides.
And you're providing a curriculum, or you're providing actual educators who are going into the classroom?
So we do both. We have two COSER agreements. One is we have one community educator, and she is going in and she's actually providing the lessons in several school districts. There are six other school districts that are on another agreement where I train their counseling staff or their health teachers to provide the lessons in the classroom themselves. And we provide a lot of consultation and a lot of extra training and extra knowledge to those districts that we are training to implement themselves as well.
What's the age range? Is there any point where this is too young to get started with, or is this something that goes even into the youngest grades of elementary school?
Absolutely. The curriculum that we utilize through the Monique Barr Foundation is kindergarten through 12th grade. The Aaron's Law mandate specifies kindergarten through 8th grade. So a lot of the school districts are implementing kindergarten through 8th grade, but I think that there's going to be an interest in continuing on into the higher grade levels, and that's the great thing about it is that it goes kindergarten through 12th grade. I do know that Monique Barr is also working on a pre-K curriculum as well. So to answer your question, it's never, you want to start conversations with your kids really, really young. And I think that it's absolutely appropriate if done in a developmentally appropriate manner.
It's Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. We are talking about the allegations that have been made against a local elementary school principal, Kirk Ashton from Northwood Elementary School in the Hilton District. We're talking with Deb Rosen and Stephanie Schwebka of the Bavona Child Advocacy Center. I want to bring in our other guests as well, Dr. Elizabeth Murray from Golisano Children's Hospital and Dr. Renee Sorrentino joining us from the Institute for Sexual Wellness and Harvard Medical School in Boston. And you as well at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or locally at 263-9994 in Greater Rochester, or you can tweet at me at Scott Feibusch. Dr. Murray, you certainly have the pulse on a lot of community conversations on these issues. What are you hearing as this kind of has a chance to sink in and as the community begins to digest this horrific story out of the Hilton District?
Similar to what I think Deb was saying about there is so many mixed emotions, parents understandably in shock, grief, and some guilt of could they have done something differently to prevent this. But I also am hearing so much about the talk of, wait, there's skills we can give our kids to prevent this or to make it not happen again, and we need those skills. And so I do think that this has opened up a huge conversation. And a critically important conversation. Every year there is historically been some amount of education that will happen in schools, and we frequently will have children come forward. It's not usually to such a huge scale as we're seeing right now with the specific Hilton case, but it happens time and time again. And Stephanie's point about the developmentally appropriate education is so critical. Children, young children, need to know about their bodies And it's sometimes hard as parents. I'm a parent too, and sometimes it can be hard to have those conversations. But it really is so critically important for all ages to have conversations that fit their developmental needs at the time.
I am a parent too. It is absolutely one of the most difficult things, I think, that there is to do as a parent, especially, you know, it's a topic that children don't want to talk about necessarily with their parents. What are some of the other safe spaces? I mean, one of the things that is disturbing about this is that we teach our children that teachers and principals and school administrators are supposed to be safe people that they can go to talk to. And then you get confronted with something like this, where somebody who is supposed to be a safe protector of a child was, and we emphasize allegedly, this case has not yet had its day in court, and we'll see what comes of it when it gets there. These are still allegations that have been made. But how do you work with that with children, whether it's as a pediatrician, Dr. Murray, or whether it's as an educator through Bavona? Where do you even begin to teach children how to have that skill if we as adults don't necessarily know who the trustworthy people turn out to be? I'll let you start this one, Dr. Murray.
Yeah, well, kids, I think, actually a lot of times are better at it than we are, because as adults, we put in so many extra layers. And kids usually just want simple answers to their questions, they're not necessarily these huge weighted questions that they feel like they are, again, because of the way we think about it as adults. But I think kind of move away from the value judgment based on a person's role in a child's life, and kind of talking about good versus bad. We need to move away from those things and give kids the skills to make their own assessments about what feels safe and appropriate. You know, so simple things like, especially as we're coming out of the pandemic and we have little children that maybe have not seen relatives for 9 months, a year, and their memory of them might not be so great. And so we might say, you know, hey, give your aunt a hug, and they might not want to, and that's okay. We should never be, you know, forcing any kind of physical contact. But I think kind of just having those conversations about, first and foremost, these are your body parts and these are the appropriate names. If your child can speak confidently about their body, that will help them should they have a medical problem with any of those body parts. We do see that. You know, 50% of my clinical time is spent as a pediatric emergency medicine doctor, and then 50% in the child abuse program here at Bavona. And I'll tell you, as an emergency medicine doctor, we've had some really sad cases where children have had accidental injuries to private parts and are so worried about talking about them that they sit and suffer in silence for a day or more, and because they're afraid to say that something's wrong with that body part. And so we need to really make sure that it's overall health. It's not just sex abuse prevention. This is an overall health issue. So if we take it from the point of healthy bodies, healthy minds, healthy spirits, I think that can help parents feel a little bit more comfortable about starting the conversations.
At a time when there are so many other mental health issues that are plaguing kids and parents as we work through everything else that's external to this right now. Dr. Sorrentino, I want to bring you into the conversation as well, and I thank you for taking the time to join us. From Boston, your area of expertise is on sort of on the other side of this in treating and evaluating sexual offenders and trying to identify who is most likely to end up as an offender in a situation like this, but you also have a particular, very personal connection to this situation. Explain where you fit into to Rochester and to the Hilton District.
Sure. Thanks, Scott. I have a range of responses to this child sexual abuse case. I am actually a Hilton native and a Northwood Elementary School student back in the early 1980s. But what I wanted to share from my personal experience and my professional experience is that my strongest reaction to this is actually disappointment. And that is because we can do this much better. We actually know quite a bit about the modus operandi of offenders in organizational settings, including schools. And I think we need to start getting serious and talking about implementing what we know about the research, in using that to help one of the largest public health problems that we have. So my area of expertise is working with organizational systems to help them identify through screening and training of staff to understand some red flags and really to focus on what we can do better using what we know about offenders in this in these settings.
And one of the things I know that you've written about is that trying to do this the way it's traditionally been done through one criminal background check at the time of hiring doesn't really work, right?
Right. So it's the standard of care for most youth-serving organizations is to use criminal background checks. And we know that that doesn't work. We know that the offenders typically do not have a criminal background. Not that we should, you know, get rid of that. But the question is, why are we continuing to rely on that as the major screening tool when we know it doesn't apply to the individuals that perpetrate in that setting?
So what are some of the tools that you think are better for this?
Well, I think, you know, in addition to what we're talking about in terms of training the students or the children, we need to train the staff. We need to have a cultural change so that the staff actually feel comfortable reporting concerning situations. We also need to change how we meet and relate to children, so having more supervision, having less opportunity to meet with individuals one-to-one without other adults available. So I think there's multiple aspects that we could explore and implement to decrease this. From my experience, talking about screening and looking at what we know about some of the risk factors and individuals that engage in this behavior. So some of the screening tools that might be implemented are a series of questions that help us understand whether the potential volunteer or employee has cognitive distortions. These are thoughts that really rationalize or fuel child sexual abuse. Do they understand boundaries? Are they someone that demonstrates in the way that they answer questions that they're higher risk, that they're more likely to engage in these kinds of behaviors? So I think it's frustrating that we haven't started to implement some of what we know from the research. And the idea that we're expecting child sexual abuse in these settings to decrease without implementing the science is particularly frustrating to me.
Is it a problem also? I mean, as districts now, you know, are going to be struggling, we think, with higher staff turnover in the wake of retirements and people moving around as the pandemic, we hope, comes to an end, as teachers try to recover from having been remote and going back into being in person. What sort of additional pressures do you think this is going to put on districts that are just trying desperately to make sure that they're keeping up with all kinds of rapidly changing staffing needs?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that it's going to confound the situation. Probably one of the biggest reasons for not implementing some of these policies is funding. And if you kind of look to see what countries are doing better at this, I would reference actually Australia has just spent over $400 million to research and implement these kinds of principles in the school. So I think that with the lack of funding or people's you know, prioritizing this, that this isn't going to change. But we really need to start looking at this differently and implementing other tools. I did want to mention there is a tool available that is used as screening that helps us identify who has pedophilic interest. So that would be an individual who has sexual interest in prepubescent individuals. Now, that certainly doesn't make up all of the offenders in this situation, but it is a risk factor for engaging in child sexual abuse. So wouldn't it be helpful to screen out those individuals who are looking to work with our children and demonstrate pedophilic interest?
And this is the Diana screen that you're referring to?
The Diana screen is one of the tools that has that capacity, yes.
And how does that work? This is something that's given as an in-person test, as an online test. How do you go about administering this?
It's a computerized test. It has two components. One is answering questions, and that's really trying to get at whether the individual has attitudes or behaviors that facilitate child sexual abuse. That gets to some of what I was calling cognitive distortions or thoughts that rationalize the behavior. And then the second component actually has the individual look at a series of images, and what it does is it helps us understand whether the individual has pedophilic interest. It's based on something called visual reaction time, which is the longer that they look at images that's associated with sexual interest. So it's about an hour to take that test. And again, it's just a screening test, but it'll help us identify whether there's cognitive distortions and or whether there's an interest in prepubescent individuals.
What is your sense, and we'll broaden this question out when we come back from a break in a moment, but what is your sense, Dr. Sorrentino, how widespread is this? I mean, obviously there are a lot of people now in the Hilton District and then in Rush Henrietta, where he was an administrator and a teacher before that, you know, who are realizing that Kirk Ashton was in the district and was involved with their children over a career that goes back now 25 years, who I'm sure are asking what didn't we know that might have been out there? Is this something that parents should be concerned is much more widespread, or is this something that there can be some sense at least that, okay, we have found one person who is an offender and we can generally trust most of the teachers who are out there as being the good people that they appear to be?
You know, it's hard to say. What we do know is, just to kind of give you a ballpark, the prevalence of child sexual abuse is something 18 to 20% for girls and more like 7 to 8% for boys. But you're now asking the question, what's the percentage of child sexual abuse in organizational settings like schools? That's hard to know. Actually, depending on what study, it may be as low as 1%. And then in other studies, of course, depending on the age and how the questions are asked to the individuals, the percentage can go up to 20%. So I can't give you a good example estimate about the prevalence. What I can give you, I think a good estimate is that what we're doing right now in terms of screening is not working or is not effective.
That's kind of frightening as a parent. I'm not going to lie. That's kind of frightening as a parent. We are going to take a little breather here. It's kind of an intense topic, so we are going to take our one break of the hour here. We are talking with Deb Rosen and Stephanie Schwebke of the Bavona Child Advocacy Center here in Rochester. Dr. Elizabeth Murray, who is an assistant professor of pediatrics and a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital and also works with Bavona, and Dr. Renee Sorrentino on the line with us from Boston at the Institute for Sexual Wellness and the Harvard Medical School. We want to bring you into the conversation as well when we come back from our break here on Connections.
Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about the legalization of marijuana and the decisions that individual towns will have to make. Should they allow smoking in town parks or town buildings on public property? What does reasonable regulation of home cultivation look like? What other restrictions should be placed on marijuana consumption in your town? We'll talk about it next hour.
And we are back on Connections with Evan Dawson, albeit without Evan Dawson today. I'm Scott Feibusch, sitting in for Evan, and we are having a difficult but I think necessary conversation about the allegations that have been made against a now former elementary school principal in the Hilton District at Northwood Elementary School, Kirk Ashton, charged with sexually abusing 11 students at least over the course of at least 4 years at his school during school hours. All the victims were boys between the ages of 8 and 12. These are, again, we emphasize, allegations. The case has yet to make it to court, but it is a serious topic. It is a topic of great concern for parents, and that includes me. I have children who are in the schools here, and it's something that I worry about. That I know, going back to my days in the schools here, there was that one teacher, and you know, at least back in the 80s, he just kind of disappeared one day, and all of a sudden there was a different teacher running those programs one day, and it was kind of never spoken of again. I'm going to guess, Dr. Elizabeth Murray at Golisano Children's Hospital, that probably is not the best way 4 decades later that we would advise handling this issue with children who probably want to know what the heck is going on around them, right?
Right. And I think, you know, a lot of the myths about abuse and child sexual abuse come from a place of comfort, as bizarre as it might be to say. It's a lot easier to give into the stereotypes of the, you know, there's this boogeyman-like creature that does this, because thinking about the what the data tells us, that, you know, 90% of the cases, the person is somebody the child knows, loves, and trusts, that's much harder to wrap our brains around and feel comfortable discussing with a child. So that's why kind of just the general skills are going to be so critical. But children are smart, and children are inquisitive, and they want to know what's going on. And so if we can have the discussions with them in an age-appropriate way, that'll be beneficial for them, because we know also that children can do an amazing job of kind of coming up with their own answers. You know, if you think about a child whose maybe the parents are going through a divorce, we often hear the children somehow think it's their fault. Well, in situations of abuse, children can often think that somehow their body has been hurt and damaged and changed in some way, and that is often not the case. But again, children will often think that somehow that this is their fault, and we need to make sure that they know that that is certainly not the case at all.
Stephanie Schwebka, you are the manager of community education at Pavona Child Advocacy Center. We know in this specific case that these kids came forward at some point after having had your education program there. On a more general level, without speaking specifically, as I know you can't, to this exact case, how do you get children who, you know, I know at least from looking at my children, you know, they don't want to talk about this, and they certainly don't want to talk about this in front of mom and dad. It's uncomfortable. It's embarrassing. It's kind of gross sometimes, depending on the age. How do you get them to a point of comfort where, if something like this is happening, that they feel like, okay, even having been violated by somebody, here's somebody else that I can actually trust now to get some justice and to get some resolution from this?
Sure. So, it's really all in the structure and the developmentally appropriate language that we utilize in the lessons that is actually super empowering for kids. And so we teach them 5 safety rules. And within those rules, they can understand the things that they can do in order to recognize red flags and how to self-advocate. We teach them, you know, safe adults. I think Dr. Murray did an amazing job describing, you know, how children really do, you know, it's like we can tell them, you know, like just because this adult's around you, it's not automatic trust. Kids have a really great sense of that. And so we tap into that in the lessons, and we talk about safety and what that means. And then we apply that to think about the adults around you. And we do an activity with the kids, and we tell them, we want you to identify at least one safe adult, you know, when you're at home or if you're visiting grandma or whatever, but we also want you to find a safe adult at school, someone that you feel like that you can talk to. And we define what that might look like for them, but ultimately they get to decide, and they think about their own environments, and they think about the lessons and the red flags we're talking about. And they do such an amazing job in the lessons of kind of piecing that together for themselves. And they do ask a lot of questions when we're doing the lessons, and they're like, well, gosh, what if my, like, trusted adult all the time at home isn't always safe like you're describing? And we can work through that, and we talk about that in class. We're like, okay, well, follow your safety rules. It all comes down to these safety rules, and the kids learn them, and they're easy to apply to all sorts of safety and dangers in their lives. So that's great. The other piece of the lessons that I like that really ties to this question is we feel like it's really important to engage parents. We want to, if this is the first time kids have been engaged in this type of conversation, a letter goes home with the kids, and we encourage kids, like, teach your parents the safety rules, hoping that that's going to be a little bit easier way for us adults and us parents who might feel super uncomfortable in this conversation, to engage with their kids and say, what'd you learn today? Tell me more about that. And it's such a great way for kids to have that conversation with their parents.
that isn't so embarrassing. And they're super proud of themselves because they love teaching the five safety rules. And such a great way for parents to either reinforce the concepts that might have already started in the house, or to really start opening up that type of conversation with their kids. So it's super important. And those letters come home, and everything that we teach in the lessons is described in that letter so that the parents know exactly what was taught and what they can, you know, sort of engage in further conversation with their kids.
We go to the phones at 844-295-TALK. And Betsy in Brighton, you are with us with this difficult but important conversation with Deb Rosen and Stephanie Schwebke from Bavona, Dr. Elizabeth Murray at Golisano Children's Hospital, and Dr. Renee Sorrentino joining us from Boston. Go ahead, Betsy.
I was wondering what they did with regard to teaching young adolescents about grooming behavior, because there's a former cross-country coach that was known to groom young girls and then line up his, predatory behaviors as soon as they became legal age. And he's recently hit the news again for similar behaviors at Kinesis College. And I know the lawyers there are trying to get information for anybody who has information on this in the past. But and I know the schools can be put in a tough situation with somebody who's treading the fine line of legality, but do they do training for young adults or young teens to look out for somebody who's giving a lot of positive attention that can be sometimes misinterpreted by a teen?
Sounds like a question for our guests from Bavona. Deb or Stephanie, one of you want to tackle that?
Yeah, I'll defer to Stephanie on that. I am curious to hear what our curriculum has to say about inappropriate attention like grooming.
Sure. So the language that we utilize in our lessons is red flags. Grooming is a highly adult term, especially for our elementary age kiddos. And so really what we understand as adults as grooming behaviors, we define for kids as red flags. These are red flags. If someone's making you feel uncomfortable, if someone's touching you in a way that you don't like, if someone's trying to talk to or take pictures of you or of your private body parts, and we describe what their private body parts are, the parts of the body that are covered by a swimsuit. So these are all things that we discuss in a way, again, that is cognitively and developmentally appropriate. Now, the curriculum that we use is from the Monique Burr Foundation. They have an Athlete Safety Matters curriculum. So that is something that can be purchased and implemented pretty easily by any district, really, that would want to emphasize these lessons and emphasize it in their athletic areas. And it can also be implemented, you know, travel soccer clubs, YMCA sports, any youth sports organizations could purchase the Athlete Safety Matters as a standalone lesson and implement that pretty easily with all very similar language and similar lesson structure.
Okay. Yeah.
If you don't mind, I'll just piggyback on that a little
sure.
bit. This is Deb.
Sure.
One thing about grooming behavior, and I want to acknowledge for the caller and for everybody else who's listening, that grooming is one of the most complex and disturbing aspects of the dynamics around child safety abuse, child sexual abuse. It is a really very disturbing phenomena that takes place and is seen really almost without exception in child sexual abuse cases. I would also point, though, to another curriculum that we use, which is called Darkness to Light, which educates adults about child sexual abuse. So Darkness to Light is not for children, very much not for children. It is for adults. And it really describes the prevalence, dynamics, and impacts of child sexual abuse, including the role of grooming, so that adults are able to spot inappropriate behavior that's coming from other adults. So I think that in particularly in youth serving organizations, adults have a role and a responsibility around observing the behavior of their fellow adults. And grooming is something that in many cases is readily detectable by other adults because it is, simply put, an inordinate amount of attention being placed on an individual child by a given adult. So I think that, our education of adults really is an important piece of identifying and stopping grooming.
And that presumably is parents, is teachers, is support staff, is administrators, is everybody, right?
Correct. Is everybody in the entire environment.
This is Renee. I totally agree with that. I spend a fair amount of my time trying to educate jurors about how perpetrators go undetected because grooming is very complex. And probably one of the more effective ways of addressing that is to educate the individual, the adults around the individual, and to really put together some strict policies about whether adults are alone with children, to have an increase in on-site supervision, and really implement these policies because grooming is really sophisticated, and to leave it to the child to be able to detect, even families to be able to detect, I think is going to come up with further problems.
And Roger emailed us at connections@wxxi.org to say in the future, he says it should be mandatory that at least two people be present during any interaction with a vulnerable person. Children are vulnerable. A child should never be allowed to be alone with any adult other than a parent. I certainly see that argument. I'm thinking especially right now when teachers are stretched to the breaking point trying to supervise remote learning and sometimes in-person learning at once also. Is it practical in today's school environment to even try to have a policy like that? Dr. Sorrentino, is that something you would advise as a reasonable policy going forward?
Yeah, so before we get to the practicality, let me just tell you a little bit about what we know about the modus operandi for individuals that engage in child sexual abuse in this setting. Some studies show us that the majority of these individuals talk about taking advantage of the relaxed and complacent environment. So I think as we start to understand what the modus operandi is, that these individuals talk about being in schools or places where no one's watching them, there's not the expectation that there's oversight, and that they really kind of capitalize on the adversarial nature of disciplinary procedures. So as we look at how individuals are getting away with the child sexual abuse, I think we can start to look at whether we can do it right now, we need to get additional funding and support. I think that is one of the answers, is to start to structurally have these things in place, because we know these individuals are taking advantage of these loose rules.
You are listening to Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch, in with Evan Dawson as we enter the final 8 minutes or so of our conversation with Deb Rosen and Stephanie Schwebke from Bavona, Dr. Elizabeth Murray from Golisano Children's Hospital, and Dr. Renee Sorrentino joining us from the Institute for Sexual Wellness in Boston. Dr. Murray, you are on the ground. You see a lot of different pieces of the puzzle here. What's your take on this? Is it realistic to even think that we could get to a point where you could say, okay, there's no time where you would ever have children alone with just one adult in a school setting?
I do think it is, if we make it a priority. I mean, we have to decide what we want to do. Do we want to continue to believe the myths and the rumors because it makes us more comfortable? Or do we want to do what we know is safe and effective, but perhaps a little bit more costly to help prevent this from happening to children? And it's easy to other it or, you know, to push it away, but that's not, at the end of the day, that's not going to help children. The trouble is, of course, is that especially right now, all districts are being pulled in a million different directions and there's a lot of financial concerns. There's always going to be financial concerns. However, I think it's not that hard to have the open door policy of a teacher or a principal literally be open door. You're never in a closed room with a minor by yourself, things like that. I think it's probably not that hard to do. And it is just so critically important. We have to decide what our priorities are going to be.
hopefully we are in the final months of having to do remote learning as a routine thing. But I know, you know, I'd love to be able to tell you that I know exactly what my kids are doing at all times when they're sitting in front of a screen and working with a teacher that way. And the reality of it is, of course, I don't come anywhere close to knowing what the heck they're doing most of the time in that situation. I've got other things I'm trying to do. They're each in their own rooms. How worried should parents be about what may or may not be happening in that kind of a setting right now?
So digital citizenship and understanding how that all works is a really important life skill. And I've been a big advocate for schools working from kindergarten up with teaching children about all the ins and outs and the aspects and the subtleties of whether it be social media or just being able to make connections online with people anywhere in the world. And so it is an important skill. And maybe we start with when your children are younger and they're using a tablet or maybe playing an online game, they're sitting at the kitchen table doing that. They're not off in a room by themselves. And so there's a fair bit of observation happening and then engagement and discussion. The Zoom classroom situation, you're right, is different and is challenging. But as parents, we certainly are allowed and have the right to check in as much as we want, understandably. There are work constraints and other things going on. But, you know, just like we were having the kind of discussion with our kids about what did you do at school today when they were doing in-person learning and who'd you see, who'd you talk to. You know, sometimes those conversations are hard to pull out. You know, that I miss the drive home from school. You know, usually you get some good conversations with your kids when you're alone in the car with them, right? But maybe you do just take an extra drive so you can have that alone time with your child to make sure you're really checking in and seeing what's going on with them. But I think it's something that we need to be aware of. We need to be concerned about, but small interventions, small steps, small acknowledgments of I'm here, I'm around, I'm in your environment, I'm checking in with you, I think can go a long way to help ensure some safety.
I want to throw another difficult question into this too, because one of the things, you know, one of the pieces of advice that's out there right now, you know, especially in the immediate wake of this incident in Hilton, is okay, if you suspect that something happened with your child, here's the number for the state police and you should call them and contact them. And you know, clearly we know that there is a different set of reactions and relationships between calling the police if you are in a suburban community and what some of those expectations of dealing with police as a safe space and a trusted space might be in some urban communities right now. Is that an additional concern right now as we try to provide children with the resources to be able to safely report this?
I'm happy to start answering that. I think Deb would probably is going to have some good information to share as well, too. But I think, you know, there are many different avenues and resources, and they don't necessarily always have to start with the police, right? The child is making a disclosure because they want to be safe and they want to be heard. And that can mean a different thing to a different child. Everybody's going to have their kind of own take on what being safe means to them. And again, as adults, a lot of times we can put our perceptions on it, but it might be something different for the child. And so whether it be involving talking to a pediatrician first, because that might be a known trusted person for your family, and having them help navigate the system, whether it be if you're locally reaching out to Bavona or many different communities across the country and across the state have their own child advocacy centers to get some advice to see where this needs to go. There are other avenues to enter into the discussion of getting a child and a family the help they need that don't necessarily have to start with the police. But I think you're exactly right that, you know, there are understandably many segments of our population that are not comfortable interacting with the police, and I totally understand that. The good news, as I see it for us here, we are very spoiled in that we have a really amazing, dedicated team of officers that work with us at Bavona, that this is their calling and this is their career and this is what they do. And we are, this concept of a multidisciplinary team, I think, is really just so critically important because you have the bonds of everybody working together day in and day out and knowing each other well and knowing that we are all part of a trusted team together.
And to clarify,
and family see that.
And to clarify, make sure we're giving credit where it's due. This is a New York State Police team that you're referring to.
At Pomona, no, we have representative from Rochester Police Department, Monroe County Sheriff, and we do have a state trooper that's co-located right here at Pomona. So depending, and then of course, if a case happens to come up in Brighton, there's officers assigned from Brighton or whatever town police may be involved. But there is a team that is always here, always working on these cases. And so having that relationship, I think families see that when they come to the advocacy center, they see the teamwork.
We are down to our final couple of minutes here, and I want to try to end this on at least something vaguely resembling a hopeful note. Dr. Renee Sorrentino in Boston, in about 20, 30 seconds, hopefully, what is your vision for how we can do a better job of making sure we're hiring responsible people?
Well, Scott, I heard you say as a parent that you felt uncomfortable with some of what we're talking about, and I'm sure you echo what many parents feel. And what I hope the listeners take from this is that discomfort leads to really demanding better practices in youth-serving organizations, to demanding that we start to use what we know about these perpetrators to do some structural changes, some of the things that we talked about, not having students alone, having more oversight, to when they first walk in the door for the job, whether they're going to be a volunteer or whether they're going to be a school teacher, there needs to be some screening tool that is better than our criminal background checks. And then we need to implement these things and see what the results are. We talked about whether it was practical or not to have students with one or more adult. Why don't we put some of those into practice in some school systems and see what the data is, see if we're actually preventing child sexual abuse.
It's a great conversation. I would love to bring some school administrators in and talk to them about how the practical realities perhaps could play in with that. Deb Rosen, Executive Director of Pomona Child Advocacy Center. Stephanie Schwebke, the Manager of Community Education at Pomona. Dr. Elizabeth Murray, the Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital. And Dr. Renee Sorrentino was with us from Boston. Thank you all so much for being with us. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson. It's Connections from Member Support Public Radio.